WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Don't shoot!
13 days after the shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a white police officer, the violence and unrest in the streets appear to have subsided. ABC.
Obviously, the killing of unarmed black people by mostly white police, or just trigger-happy white people, has gone on for a long, long time. Long before the death of Michael Brown in Missouri 2 weeks ago, or of Trayvon Martin in Florida 2 years ago. It's just that now, the media are paying more attention. As MSNBC's Tremaine Lee told us last week,
since the killing of Trayvon Martin, you've had the killing of Jordan Davis in Jacksonville, Florida, by someone who began an altercation with this young man over his loud music and fired into his car. The Radisha McBride case in Detroit, where a young woman showed up at someone's doorstep and they fired a shotgun through a screen door and tore off half of her face. Jonathan Ferrell in Charlotte, North Carolina, he gets in a car accident. He shows up at someone's door looking for help. She calls the police. They end up gunning this young man down, again, unarmed. Eric Garner, more recently in New York City, selling loose cigarettes, died in a police chokehold. In each one of these cases, there was a mass of media around it.
He's right. The template for that coverage was set in March of 2012, some 10 days after 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was shot by a neighborhood watch captain. Ever since, the responses to these deaths by the public and the media has followed the same general trajectory, the same pattern. But Trayvon's story took the longest to take off in the mainstream. CBS was comparatively early, but look at the lag time.
Tracy Martin's teenage son was shot dead on this patch of grass 10 days ago, and the gunman belonged to a neighborhood watch group.
Then public protest mounted, though more contained than what would transpire later in Ferguson. After a couple of weeks, let's call it the context about Trayvon's character swept into the headlines, ranging from the chemical, Martin had traces of marijuana in his blood, to the sartorial.
I think the hoodie is as much responsible for Trayvon Martin's death as George Zimmerman was.
Twitter played a big role, spawning communities with such hashtags as hoodies and Skittles and I am Trayvon Martin. And then the president weighed in.
I think all of us have to do some soul searching to figure out how does something like this happen.
It was an uncharacteristically personal call for introspection.
You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
And as the public waited for justice to be served, or not.
No justice for me! No justice for me! No justice.
The Reverend Al Sharpton showed up.
All over the world, they're calling for justice for Trayvon.
So, that's the pattern. You have the killing, the protest, mainstream media catching on, the hashtags, attempts to explain the killing of unarmed people with how they looked or what they smoked or drank or did or may not have done at some other time. Then Sharpton shows up, some high official speaks, and then someone invokes a national conversation.
There is much more to this issue than news headlines, so we invite you to take part in a national town hall about race relations in America. What are the challenges? What are the solutions to unity?
For Jordan Davis, like Trayvon, also 17, also killed in Florida the same year, in Jordan's case, by a man who said he felt threatened by the expletive-laced rap music blasting from the kid's car, and who also claimed to see a gun that was never found, the arc of the coverage was the same, but highly accelerated. Then, November 2nd, 2013, 19-year-old Renisha McBride crashes her car in a Detroit suburb and then loudly knocks on the window and door of a house, whereupon the owner fires a shotgun blast through the door into her face. Initially, the coverage is only local. Then the family speaks out, igniting protests and hashtags. And a few days after that, the networks jump in. Congressman John Conyers speaks. Al Sharpton speaks. The toxicology report says she was drunk. Her lifestyle, derived in part from her cell phone photos, is discussed. And finally, there's a call for a national conversation, in her case, about stand your ground laws, which Michigan, like Florida, also has. Last month in Staten Island, Eric Garner's horrifying death in a police chokehold is captured on video.
I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe.
The mainstream media arrives as swiftly as the protests and hashtags and Al Sharpton. We quickly learn Garner was selling loose cigarettes. Hey, that's not legal. And then, as the widely read website Vox notes, it sparks a national conversation about the use of force by police officers. Next up, the coverage of the death of Michael Brown. The story with the fastest trajectory and the widest coverage. The world is shocked. I mean, Egypt urges the U.S. to respect peaceful free expression. And Amnesty International sends a team of observers, researchers, and trainers for the first time to America, to Ferguson. When Michael Brown is shot by police in the middle of the street on Saturday, August 9th, protests and mainstream media coverage begin immediately. Twitter plays a big role, especially the hashtag, if they gunned me down, an instant rebuttal to the wide release of the teenager scowling and splaying his fingers in what some call a gang sign, others a peace sign. The demonstrations escalate. Sharpton arrives, calling for calm.
Some of us are making the story how mad we are, rather than how promising he was. Don't be a traitor to Michael Brown in the name of you, man.
And the pattern reasserts itself. See if you can spot it.
New information this morning out of Ferguson, Missouri. Police there connecting Michael Brown to what's called a strong-armed robbery.
He might have been affected by the marijuana, so that he may have been acting in a crazy way.
I just cannot believe that this is the tactic that this police chief and his administration are using to try to make this young man be deserving to be gunned down in the street like a dog.
President Obama released a statement on this case just about 90 minutes ago. He says the death of Michael Brown is heartbreaking, and Michelle and I send our deepest condolences to his family and his community at this very difficult time.
We have to have a national conversation about how police forces should interact with the African-American community who happens to be paying their salary, who want to be served and protected.
Let's observe that the way these stories unspool in real time and on social media and soon everywhere else mostly works to the benefit of all concerned. First, to those long-ignored communities that suddenly have a global opportunity to be heard, and to those outside concerned with social justice, and to those news outlets that see ratings spike and, less cynically, a chance for relevant, important coverage. But when we heard Tremaine's list of the dead at the top of the show, he included one man who, you should pardon the expression, didn't fit the profile. Jonathan Ferrell, who knocked on a woman's door in Charlotte, North Carolina last September seeking help after a car accident, prompting a panicked 911 call and ultimately his own death from a policeman's gun. That story didn't go massively viral, because here's what happened the very next day.
Tonight, Chief Rodney Monroe solemnly answered the questions neighbors, friends of the victim, and Channel 9 had about the shooting.
Homicide investigators signed warrants for Officer Carrick for the charge of voluntary manslaughter.
The chief made no attempt to justify what happened, and he gave the public a name, Officer Randall Carrick. 2 days later, the PD released audio tapes of Carrick speaking to the dispatcher. And now, after the state's initial failure to indict Carrick, he's awaiting trial. To be sure, there's no happy ending, but it was a reasonable start. Whether the shooter is an officer or a civilian, it's police departments that ultimately determine how the story is told. This power to attract or deflect the press is probably the most powerful weapon in their highly militarized arsenals. But they haven't used it. Maybe it seems hard. Maybe they haven't seen the value. Maybe they will now. Coming up, the view of Ferguson from inside Ferguson and from outside our borders.
For example, El Mundo, a right-wing Spanish newspaper, interpret Obama's words of peace and reconciliation are perceived by many activists as an inadequate and almost treason to a situation they see as a direct result of slavery and racial segregation laws.
This is On the Media.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has promised decisive action against Islamic militants in Iraq.
We are pursuing a long-term strategy against ISIL because ISIL clearly poses a long-term threat.
We'll speak to military analyst Andrew Bacevich about what those strategic options are. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from these business partners: Prairie Ridge Farms, Allerton; Roland Realty Incorporated, Champaign; Michael Walker Consulting, Urbana; and Strategic Farm Marketing, Champaign. Join these businesses and other friends who help make great programs possible. Thank you.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. By week's end, reporters in Ferguson found that where once they were most afraid of tear gas canisters hurled or bullets fired by the police, now they were also wary of people on the ground, people from outside the community who had come to join the chaos. Local station KMOV-TV has been on the ground there since the night of the shooting.
Every night, News 4 has been on the street with police and demonstrators to
report. Tonight, no looting, no violence, but there were 47 arrests.
Brittany Noble, who's live at West Florissant in Canfield. What kind of reaction have you seen tonight, Brittany?
Well, Chris, the situation here continues to change.
Now the station's news department is puzzling over how to continue covering a dramatic story with no end in sight. KMOTV news director Brian Tuvino says the most urgent issue for the station is this: will too much live coverage lead to more violence on the ground?
How much publicity do we give to these groups who are not from St. Louis? Because by and large, most of the people who are in St. Louis having their daily protests, they go home at night. They are peaceful when things are, you know, getting a little rowdy in the evening. It's the factions that have a different agenda who are the ones who are inciting police at that point. So we just have to make a judgment call, and this is almost a daily basis, about what we carry outside of our normally scheduled newscasts.
Were you hearing from people in the community or your own reporters that the news coverage was actually affecting the events on the ground?
Well, I would say how you perceive their issues and why are they out there. It's a very racially divided story here in St. Louis. You see it in social media. You see it in comments made back to our news department. We just can't come off as rooting on something that's going on in our community, meaning nothing's happened yet, but we're here waiting for something to happen.
So you don't do play-by-play, gavel-to-gavel coverage of the street?
Well, in the early days, when it was involving St. Louis residents, you would have some of our competitors carrying wall-to-wall play-by-play coverage of a police line with maybe one, two people in front of it, making, you know, a stand for whatever reason. Well, as that goes on for 10 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, you see more people show up. You see more people coming out. And it's like, what is really fueling all these additional people to come forward? And you just worry that, is it the live television broadcast? You just have to have that conversation. We had a very difficult discussion after we went on the air on Monday. We broke into the last few minutes of a CBS program, and that was met with some severe public backlash because many people turned to other programs to kind of escape what's going on.
What was the story?
It's about a face-off between police and protesters that was almost leading to a chaotic situation.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, we could have handled it much differently.
How?
Well, we're within 10 minutes of a regularly scheduled newscast. We could have interrupted a commercial break that was coming up and just said, you know, this is a scene that's going on. We're going to have a live report in 7 minutes.
And let your viewers finish watching the exciting conclusion of Everybody Loves Raymond or whatever.
It's actually Under the Dome. And in essence, you know, we said, this is far more important than your moment of escaping what's going on.
But you've been getting some conflicting signals from the public, right?
There are mixed signals. You know, it's like, what really do you want? On one hand, you have people saying, enough already. We want you to stop covering the story because you're only fueling the fire. But then every morning we see what the ratings were on the previous day, and ratings in St. Louis for all stations are markedly higher than they typically are.
Has the huge press of national and international journalists changed the way your station can cover the riots?
Well, you know, you would have camera crews from CNN, from MSNBC running back and forth in front of your camera. We actually had a reporter who was in the field doing a live interview with a local alderman, and somebody comes in from outside of the area, outside of the country, and tries to interrupt our interview that's live on the air in St. Louis. I mean, at the end of the day, we're the St. Louis local media. We're the ones who deal with the ramifications of what's going on before Michael Brown's tragic shooting death and after. The Wednesday after Michael Brown was shot and killed by the police officer, we organized a town hall meeting of community leaders, African American and white, to have a discussion about how we got here, how we got to not only the distrust of police, but also what would lead to the reaction that took place in the days following.
You're talking about having a national conversation.
Our title was a community conversation about how we can start the process of fixing many of these issues. But it's going to take our communities to do it. And I think that's where the local media comes in. And you'll never see the national media, for the most part, back here again once the play-by-play nature of this is over with.
Okay, Brian. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Tuvineau is news director of KMOV-TV, St. Louis. As local KMOV-TV ponders its own coverage, a tidal wave of national and global media engulfs Ferguson, a town of 20,000 people. What story do they tell? Sarah Kenzior is an independent journalist based in St. Louis who's been following the events as a local as well as a reporter. When she first heard about Michael Brown's death on Twitter, she doubted that the national media would care.
I saw it on the Twitter account of Tefpo, who is a local rapper and writer and activist, the Instagram picture of Michael Brown's stepfather holding the sign saying his son had been executed in the street. And at the time, I was honestly wondering if any national media was going to cover the story at all. I definitely didn't expect the situation where you go to a protest and the protesters will be vastly outnumbered by the number of media figures who are taping them.
Can you describe what the presence of the media feels like in Ferguson?
It's very overwhelming. On Tuesday, I was in a barbershop with Umar Lee, who's another local journalist, and we were talking to people who were working there, and stupidly, we made the decision to tweet that we were at a barbershop in Ferguson, and people in the barbershop had told us they were still feeling the effects of the tear gas. Within minutes of Umar and I tweeting that, Al Jazeera America rushed in, CNN rushed in, the clientele of the barbershop left, one of the barbers walked out. Umar was just getting a trim. This trim ended up going on for 25 minutes because CNN thought he made a great background shot. Of course, it's very important for the story to be told. I think it's also a great inconvenience for a lot of locals in the area.
And yet, you've noted that the national coverage often gets it wrong, beginning with even the simplest descriptions of Ferguson.
Initially, they were referring to Ferguson as either a small town, which it's not. You know, it's part of the North County connected towns that are a suburb of the city. Or they're referring to it as a ghetto, you know, which it isn't either. Anybody who's been to Ferguson would put that kind of claim aside. I think that there's a real struggle for the national media to understand the geography of St. Louis, and particularly how that geography reflects racial politics that have been going on for decades.
And how does it?
A lot of people know about violence and poverty and crime in North St. Louis. They do not know as much about North County until recently, which is where a lot of people from North St. Louis moved to escape that environment. But particularly since 2008, the economy of North County has been suffering. And so you have a lot of suburban poverty and a lot of frustration. You know, and this has been discussed, at least locally, for a long time. The McDonald's that everybody shows in Ferguson with all the reporters sitting in it was a McDonald's where workers struck back in March.
So you think reporters basically should be better prepared when they get to town?
Treat St. Louis like a foreign country. If you don't know a place, ask questions. Pay attention to local media, and not just the Post-Dispatch, but, you know, the St. Louis American and even the Evening World.
Is that cluelessness reflected in the commentaries that you see?
There were some commentaries written by people who were writing from, you know, London or Brooklyn or something, talking about riots being a potentially good thing for St. Louis. They're referencing things like WTO protests or, you know, the protests in London after a similar case of police brutality. What people are missing is that this is a very vulnerable city. And they're assuming that when a city burns down, it rebuilds. And St. Louis is not a city that rebuilds. There's an entire section of downtown where the Pruitt-Igoe housing projects were demolished in the mid-70s that has never been rebuilt. It's a fenced-off urban forest that's used for absolutely nothing. And every year people debate what to do with that space, and every year the trees grow taller. And this is true all over the city. I would not be surprised if you start seeing pictures of just parts of the county showing crumbling buildings and burnt-out spaces and empty lots, and people are going to think that riots took place there, but that's not riots. You know, that's just apathy. And so when you think that riots are some sort of cleansing process and, like, symbolic, you know, you're forgetting that actual people live there.
What do you think is the principal difference, if there is one, between the way national and international reporters are telling the story and the way that local reporters are?
A lot of the times the national reporting hurts me in a personal way because, you know, I live here, I raise my kids here, and so when I see people treating the people of St. Louis as a sort of symbolic property and not really acknowledging them as human beings, I tend to just get angry and put it away, and I think that's probably the difference. Everybody who's a local reporter here is probably here for the long run, and so it's important to us not just that the story get told, but that the problems of the story get fixed. Reporters here, you know, obviously everyone reports the story differently, but we know that the words have consequences for us. You know, the city's future rides on this being resolved in a productive way.
When you talk about symbols, are you including the use of the war zone metaphor? You know, the ubiquitous images of protesters being hit by tear gas, the tag Ferguson, and even comparisons to Iraq and Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those comparisons are ridiculous, because what you really have is a brutal, militarized police in an American suburb. And that's significant in and of itself. You do not need, you know, a metaphor to express that. It doesn't look anything like Gaza. You know, it's a narrow strip of stores that were either burnt or looted and that are boarded up. You can go to whole, you know, neighborhoods of St. Louis that look like that and have looked like that for like 30 years.
In May of last year, you wrote an op-ed for Al Jazeera English called "The View from Flyover Country." In St. Louis, you wrote, "Possibilities are supposed to be in the past, but when the American dream is dying for everyone, St. Louis might be the one to rise up." Many have called your op-ed prophetic. Are you surprised about what's happening now?
I'm surprised at the level of attention and the passion and the intensity of the situation, but I'm not really surprised that a community came out to protest after a child from that community was killed. There have been protests in North County for the last couple of years. They're frustrated, and they've been speaking out about it.
Do you think it might be a place where there's actually some change then?
I mean, that's the question that's breaking everybody's heart. Our problems, which have been things discussed in St. Louis for a very long time, are now, you know, an international talking point. And city officials have long been very defensive about St. Louis's reputation. This is where Escape from New York was filmed, and they didn't even need to build a set. They just filmed what things actually looked like, and it was supposed to be a post-apocalyptic society. We are now known as a city that is synonymous with police brutality, with incompetence, with military action, with racism. And night after night, everyone in in St. Louis is gripped to the live stream a few miles from their home watching this happen and just living in fear and in shame and in anger. That's what's frightening, is that there's really no end in sight. And when you don't know what's coming, it's hard to imagine a positive change. I mean, believe me, St. Louis will change. We just don't know what kind of change it's going to be.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Kendzior is a writer, a reporter, and an anthropologist based in St. Louis. What's happened and what's happening in Ferguson is a uniquely American story, but international coverage of the shooting of Michael Brown and the aftermath reveals a lot about how America is seen around the world. Adam Taylor writes the World Views blog at the Washington Post, which explores what other countries are reporting about us. While covering the global reaction to Ferguson, Taylor says two similar angles keep appearing over and over again.
I think the first thing I'd noticed is incredible amount of sort of schadenfreude.
Oh, yeah.
The world's most powerful country could have this sort of incredible scenes happening on its streets. The one that really sticks out to me is probably Russia. It's really the classic example of sort of whataboutism. You criticize us for this, but what about these things that are going on at home? We have a Washington Post Moscow-based writer, Karun Demirjian. She points out this provides an opportunity in this era of sanctions and new Cold War-style sentiments, basically to accuse America of being a giant hypocrite.
So that's number one, schadenfreude. What's the second big thing you've noticed?
There's been quite a lot of sort of reflection on how this reflects back upon Europe's own problems. France has a lot of issues with racial problems. I'm British, so I can think of the 2011 London riots, which were also sparked by the shooting of a young black man. As much as these situations seem very similar, there's also the points where they seem very different. And one particular way that they seem very different is the police response. You know, you can walk around London or Berlin a couple of days, you probably won't see any police officers with a single gun. Then you see this incredible police militarization in Ferguson.
It's the view of the semi-automatic rifle. It's featured a lot in the European press, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just this very jarring image. I believe The Economist recently put out an article that said in the entire of last year, British police officers only fired their guns 3 times.
And resulted in no casualties, actually, in Britain.
No casualties, yes. So it's one of the reasons that the sort of European press, when they look at these things, they're not necessarily even seeing the London riots. You know, they're seeing protests in Ukraine or, you know, the Arab Spring.
Is that why some of the British press are treating the conflict as a war zone?
I would guess so, yeah. I mean, The Telegraph sent Rob Crilly, who's their Afghanistan correspondent, and he actually got arrested. Ansar Gwar, who's a journalist with Die Welt, a German newspaper, he also got arrested. And he said afterwards that, you know, he'd been to Iraq, Vietnam, China, all over the place. And the only place he's actually been arrested was the United States.
Talk about the German coverage. They appeared to have been even more harshly critical than the Brits.
Yeah, Zeit Online, which is a sort of online news site with a centrist point of view. One of the things it says is that the situation for African Americans has barely improved since Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
Says the dreams of a post-racist society which flared up after the election of Obama seem further away than ever before. Obama has this interesting link to Germany because he gave that Berlin speech a few years ago. The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, it's one of Germany's biggest newspapers, had this incredible quote that was, "It seems like a mockery that Barack Obama was still called the most powerful man on earth," suggesting that, you know, really Obama should have the power to end this, and he can't. The Spiegel, it's a news weekly, they interviewed Marcel Kulmli, who's an academic who studies police reactions, and he's contrasted the police reactions with that of the German police, pointing out the last time you saw assault rifles on the average German police officer was during the Cold War. He goes on to say things would never proceed like this in Germany.
And that perspective has been entirely replicated by the French, right?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, Le Figaro, even though it's a conservative daily, it actually points the finger at the Republican Party. It says the repercussions might be felt for a long time and even cost the GOP the next presidential elections. Even European conservatives look at the American right wing and sort of see something they can't relate to. For example, El Mundo, a right-wing Spanish newspaper, wrote that Obama's words of peace and reconciliation are perceived by many activists as an inadequate and almost treason to a situation they see as a direct result of slavery and racial segregation laws that were enforced until 1965.
Tell me about the Iranian coverage of Ferguson.
They've made a big deal out of this. Perhaps the most interesting thing about this, I'd say, is that Ayatollah Khamenei has taken to his Twitter account. I presume it's not actually him sitting there using his iPhone tweeting, but whoever's using his account has been tweeting these sort of images that show sort of racial divides in the US and really hammering home on it, which a lot of people obviously find a little ironic considering sort of the plight of various minorities in Iran, the 2011 election protests in Iran, and things like that.
There's also a certain irony in the fact that, at least the last I checked, you're not allowed to have Twitter accounts in Iran.
Yeah, that's one big point as well. This is in English. This is aimed at English speakers around the world.
Okay, so one of the tweets that Khamenei wrote was, racial discrimination is still a dilemma in the U.S. Hashtag Ferguson. You've observed that America's problem with race appears to be unique. I wonder if you can sum that up.
I think from a European's perspective, you know, obviously there's a lot of racial problems in Europe, but they're pretty distinct from America's racial problems. Like, they're almost entirely to do with 20th century immigration rather than the legacy of slavery and segregation. And so you get a lot of British and French and German writers sort of looking at their own problems, then contrasting them with the US problems and being like, well, problems have been there for centuries. Why can't America sort them out? It is interesting. You know, even in London, the riots after the death of Mark Duggan in 2011, it maybe started as a disturbance in the black community, but as it progressed, you'd see crowds were almost entirely white. And so I think when you look at the photographs as a European or an outsider and see police officers who are almost 100% white versus a crowd that is almost 100% black, it's really stark. It's very rare to see that sort of thing in Europe or really any country.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you, too.
Adam Taylor is a foreign affairs reporter and blogger at The Washington Post. It was on Tuesday, just before 5 p.m., when the first mention of a video showing the beheading of an American journalist, James Foley, surfaced on Twitter. Foley had disappeared in Syria in 2012 while working for the Boston-based online news organization Global Post. The first tweets came from a journalist named Zayad Benjamin, Washington correspondent for Radio Sawa, who noted the existence of the gruesome video titled A Message to America, purportedly from the group formerly called ISIS and now calling itself Islamic State. He didn't link to it, but Twitter blocked his account anyway. Over the next hour, as Twitter administrators played whack-a-mole with extremists who wanted the video to be seen, something extraordinary was happening among Twitter users. The hashtag ISIS Media Blackout, exhorting tweeters not to share the video or images from it, sprung up and immediately went viral. Within an hour, it was trending around the world in cities from Washington, D.C. to Paris. Shane Harris has been following this and the ISIS media campaign generally for Foreign Policy. Welcome back to On the Media.
Hi, Brooke. Thanks for having me.
You're aware of the Twitter feeds operated by Islamic State supporters. Did they get involved in any way with the conversation about the James Foley video on Twitter?
They did. In fact, there were two Twitter accounts that we know of that were suspended on Monday, the day before the video went up. And on Tuesday, they were up again, the same individuals under different account or different handle names. And they were promoting the video with celebratory kind of rhetoric and reveling, I guess, in Foley's death.
And then some of these ISIS supporters on Twitter deactivated in advance. There was one tweet by someone called @MujahidForLife who said, guys, deactivate now.
It's a very interesting strategy. I mean, it sort of is a way of kind of jumping back into the fog almost. And I think that these people who are running these accounts are very well aware of the fact that Twitter is trying to chase them down and deactivate them. You know, I've talked to people over at Twitter. They're loath to reveal how many people they have trying to police this content, but I gather that it's not many. And so really, it's kind of a losing battle for them. Just, I mean, it was almost impossible to control the spread of this video. In fact, even before people were using the hashtag, people were encouraging others to stop retweeting it and stop talking about it. People saying, I've seen the video, don't watch it. Or people saying, don't retweet this, don't promote it. That's what the Islamic State wants. To almost try and smother the fire before it spread.
The first hashtag evidently came from this woman, Libya Liberty. And she said, you know what I think? And I know how crazy this sounds, but we need an ISIS media blackout, amputate their reach, pour water on their flame. Have you ever seen this sort of thing play out on social media before?
I have never seen it play out this extensively. I mean, every now and then you'll see people saying, don't retweet jihadi propaganda videos, it's just what they want, but never in this kind of organized fashion with a hashtag and people sort of jumping on this bandwagon and saying, enough is enough, let's fight them back right now.
And I think it's remarkable because it's journalists that are calling for this kind of forbearance, and it seems like you don't agree with it.
Yeah, I don't agree with it, really. I mean, I completely understand the passion in this case because, you know, James Foley was a journalist, and journalists take that very personally. I mean, it's one of our own. But our job is to report. I think that you can report on the murder of James Foley without crossing the line into graphic or even arguably obscene imagery.
And by crossing the line, you mean what the New York Post did?
Absolutely. I mean, printing photographs of a man in the seconds before he is about to be brutally killed crosses the line. You don't need to do that to convey to readers what happened and to explain to them how this fits into the Islamic State's overall propaganda campaign. I think pretending that it's not happening or trying to shut them down, I understand the intention of trying to fight back. But as journalists, I think we have to fight against that instinct, even in this case when everything is telling us, ignore it, fight them somehow. I mean, it gave us a sense of power to be able to fight back at these guys who are trying to, in a sense, play in our wheelhouse. They're trying to create a media strategy.
And you said that this ISIS media blackout campaign has had at least as much impact as the attempts of governments.
Yeah, I think more so. I mean, governments can only do so many things. These sort of draconian measures that the Iraqi government has taken, trying to shut off internet access in parts of their country or limit people's access to Twitter and to other social media platforms, that's never going to work. It hasn't worked. This, though, is something very powerful. This is spontaneous. It's the users of that platform standing up and fighting back. And I think it's fascinating and notable, but as journalists, I think we have to resist it.
Now, I wonder if you'll forgive me, conflating a couple of things here, and you can straighten me out. Because if we can stipulate, at least for the basis of this conversation, that this kind of strategy can work, as I looked through the tweets, what they were saying was, don't retweet, don't spread around the screenshots. They're not saying, don't report on their media strategy.
That's true. I mean, I'm reading a tweet even right now that says, report the news but starve ISIS of the publicity oxygen that they crave. Focus on the victims. And I think this raises the question of, so how do we treat even James Foley himself, right? I mean, you know, drawing a line, I think, of not posting the photos of him from the video is a good one. You saw this counter campaign come up of posting photos of him from a happier time.
This was a new tactic to beat back those horrific images of his last moments, trying to reclaim the Foley that we will remember by pictures of him on the job, pictures of him calm. This is a fascinating attempt by colleagues of Foley, journalists, to seize and reshape the narrative.
It absolutely is, and I suspect that we will see this again if this, you know, tragically, you know, befalls another journalist. And I think it's very smart, honestly. I mean, it's a way of pushing back and at the same time engaging in the story and changing that narrative. And that has taken off, it seems to me, as much as the ISIS media blackout idea. And they've kind of joined forces. I mean, there are tweets that will say, ISIS media blackout, here is a pic of James Foley, and we'll show a picture of him from an earlier time.
And the fact that it's effective makes it even better. All you have to do is acknowledge your own role in this sort of ecosystem and act responsibly and appropriately. Don't retweet something. You're not a machine. Add something that changes just a little bit the narrative that's going around. If journalists can do this, then anybody can do this. To me, it's horrible, but it's kind of thrilling that it is possible to take back some of that power.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing in a moment like this is the creation of a body of ethics for how we behave in social media, which increasingly is such a huge part of how we communicate and consume news and information. It's just been a very powerful example of how really on the fly people can make up the rules for behavior and how we treat one another in this social media space, and at the same time condemn people like the Islamic State for the way that they're using it.
Shane, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brooke.
Shane Harris is a senior staff writer at Foreign Policy and is the author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex, out in November. Coming up, a little respite from reality, with fake reality.
I tend to watch The Bachelor and The Bachelorette with my wife on Monday nights. And it's a really painfully obvious manipulation of the audience when the music you're hearing is designed to suggest or move you in certain directions.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. TiVo, unifying cable TV, on-demand, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus in a single device. Learn more at TiVo.com. And Wix.com, giving business owners the ability to create their own website with the drag-and-drop builder. Learn more at Wix.com. This is NPR.
Seth Meyers is about to host the Emmys. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with him. He's sat behind the SNL Weekend Update desk, he hosts Late Night on NBC, and he even stood behind the podium at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
One that I imagine if you checked, you'd still see my grip marks in the lid.
Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Tonight at 7 on WILL FM 90.9, we present a special evening concert. Hershey Felder in Maestro, The Art of Leonard Bernstein. Felder combines first-person narrative with the compositions of Bernstein and others to draw us deeply into the maestro's fascinating life of tragedy, triumph, and music. That's a special evening concert, Hershey Felder in Maestro, The Art of Leonard Bernstein, tonight at 7 on the evening concert on WILL FM 90.9.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Sometimes, as Wordsworth said, the world is too much with us. No doubt after the last 45 minutes, you feel that way. But after so much remorseless reality, perhaps the antidote is a few minutes of low-stakes, low-down, ludicrous, fake reality. Reality that doesn't make you feel sick at heart, just slightly sullied.
Both guys say they're in love with her.
I know that Andy's in for me. I mean, I love her in ways I never thought I'd love someone before.
I'm in love with Andy, 100%. Totally in love with her.
But will either one really propose?
The average American watches more than 5 hours of TV daily. That includes not only viewing television, but also listening to it. On the Media producer Laura Mayer reports on the role music plays in your manipulation when staring fake reality in the face.
TV is where a lot of us first hear music.
So my first exposure to classical music was via Bugs Bunny cartoons on Saturday mornings. For better or for worse, it informed my whole life.
That's John Burlingame. He's a film and music television historian at the University of Southern California.
Music can help you understand where you are in terms of time and place. It can help propel the action along by speeding things up or slowing it down. But mostly, music and television is designed to elicit an emotional response from the viewer and listener.
We've all heard about television's current golden age. Breaking Bad, House of Cards, Mad Men. Prestige television that has helped elevate TV to the rank of high culture. Film music has long been analyzed by academics and cultural thinkers. Movie fans can probably name a few film composers off the top of their heads. Jerry Goldsmith, Hans Zimmer, Danny Elfman. But only a true TV obsessive can name even one prolific TV composer. David Carbonara composed the Mad Men theme, by the way.
When I wrote my first book, which was called TV's Biggest Hits, which was a history of music and television in 1996, I was the first to really discuss the history and the importance of a television theme and the importance of dramatic underscore.
While there are academic journals devoted to obscure things like packaging technology and experiments in fluids, there are no academic journals devoted to TV music. Even though, if you're an average American, you're marinating in it. And many of us marinate in reality TV, and therefore, reality TV music. Nielsen's top five broadcast programs each week regularly include more reality TV than sitcoms, drama, or news shows. Turn on your TV, open up your laptop, fire up that tablet, and you'll see reality television everywhere. You'll also hear it. You know, I must reveal myself here. I am a reality television aficionado.
My condolences.
Aside from the game-based shows, like Survivor or The Amazing Race, reality TV theme songs don't really matter. The focus is on the underscore that follows the characters and plays under almost every scene. The underscore serves an important narrative purpose. It creates storylines, sympathies, and the sense of reality itself in reality television. John Burlingame once wrote that television music is the soundtrack to our lives. The music from The Bachelor is the soundtrack to my life.
Will you marry me?
Yes, yes, sir.
I tend to watch The Bachelor and The Bachelorette with my wife on Monday nights. And it's a really painfully obvious manipulation of the audience when the music you're hearing is designed to suggest or move you in certain directions. If there's tension between, you know, the bachelorette and contestant A, you'll feel it predominantly because you're being manipulated emotionally by the music that's playing underneath.
I can't control my eyebrow. I cannot control my eyebrow. I can't control what's on my face 24/7. If I could walk around with a smile on 24/7, I would, but my face would get freaking tired.
Generally, the music used in reality television is licensed very inexpensively from music banks. Hence some of reality TV's familiar generic music for terror, humor, romance, or extra romance. The Bravo Network, with its slate of prestige reality television, is an exception to the rule of cheap, generic music cues. Aaron Kaplan has composed much of the underscores for Bravo, including Project Runway and The Real Housewives of New York, as well as A&E's Duck Dynasty. You know, prestige.
Each season presents different characters, there's new storylines, so therein lies the challenge. The process in a lot of cases involves sitting down in front of your computer and composing using a sequencer.
If you're leaning in right now, you're probably a fan of Top Chef. This is Kaplan's song, Channel Zero, which plays during the crucial judging portion of each episode. Channel Zero is the signal that tells viewers to stop folding laundry, look up from email, put down Candy Crush, and pay attention now.
People who are fans of those shows do perk up whenever, you know, they get their cue. I mean, it's Pavlovian in a way.
Richard Lawson wrote Gawker's TV recaps for years. He's now VanityFair.com's culture columnist and no longer covers reality TV for a living. But when I asked him to review some of his old Real Housewives of New York recaps, he couldn't help but get sucked back in, as when he recapped the scene when two former BFFs had an epic falling out.
There's a scene as the kind of downfall of Jill Zarin began on the Real Housewives of New York, where Bethany Frankel has left her voicemail. And the first thing Bethany says is, get a hobby.
When she said, find a hobby, it clicked in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Over. And
right.
I really, you know, made a deposit in that friendship bank. I feel like she cleaned out our bank account. Yeah.
The music is indicating support towards Jill. But if you actually paired that music away, the voicemail that Bethany left is perfectly reasonable, but because of the way it was edited and the way it was scored, it became this sort of triumphant turning point for Jill.
The fact that so many people, millions and millions of people, watch this drivel makes it important to really understand what brings us back.
John Burlingame.
And in some ways, it may be the music that is helping to make these shows successful by grounding it in some kind of emotional manipulation.
Drivel? Emotional manipulation? Those are some serious allegations. How do I feel about that? For On the Media, I'm Laura Mayer.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Andrew Chug, and the show was edited this week by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Greg Rippon and Leslie Sisson.